You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
December, really? We've been seeing storm after storm and those rainfall amounts increase. And right now we are above average for this time of year. And we're going to get more rain starting tomorrow. And the rain's going to continue all the way through midday on Friday. Right now, estimates from half an inch to about an inch and a half. And we have another storm arriving over Christmas weekend. That one.
Yeah, that's what the local NBC weather report sounded like just a few weeks ago. Since then, of course, hardly a drop during the month of January, the month that's supposed to be the wettest. And nothing more in the forecast for February either, at least for the next couple of weeks. The fact is, much of California is still in a severe drought, and some local water agencies in places like Pasadena, Glendale, Simi Valley, and Diamond Bar are starting up with water restrictions again. Joining me now to talk about what this means and what we can expect going forward is Alex Tardy. He's the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in San Diego, and Alan Haynes, hydrologist in charge at the National Weather Service's California-Nevada River Forecast Center. Thanks to you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, glad to be here.
Alan, the snowpack was at 160% of normal. This week it was measured at 92%. I mean, 92% is not terrible. That's an A. So why are we talking about California still being in a drought?
Well, you know, drought is, of course, a political term. At the end of the day, what really matters is how much water is available for people to use. And if you look back over the last 10 years, maybe even 20 years, arguably, we've basically been in a drought for that period, punctuated by a few wet years, maybe in some cases a few big storms that helped out. And so we had a really big a storm in October that was looking promising, and then November was dry. December had a couple of wet periods, as you were playing in your playback memory there, and things were looking great, and then January turned out to be dry. And January is one of the big months that we need to really build the snowpack. So California is designed to weather these droughts with large reservoirs that can carry over, because we know it's very, you know, highly variable from year to year, although the last 10 to 20 years have been much more variable, it seems. And so when you have multiple dry years, you draw those reservoirs down. With an average snowpack and having the starting out with low reservoirs, it's going to be a hard time to get those where we really want them to be.
Alex, for the folks who don't know and have been hearing this phrase bandied about, what exactly is the phenomenon known as La Nina, and how is it affecting our weather here in Southern California?
Yeah, so La Nina is the cold phase of the ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean, way south of Hawaii. And most are like rolling their eyes, like, what does that have to do with California? Well, in this case, it's partially the blame. It does affect our weather patterns. But one thing I've learned in California is you're going to be very disappointed if you hang your hat too much on La Nina or the relative El Nino, which is the warm phase. And what I mean is our years, like Alan mentioned, have been so variable, and this year is no exception, that there's other phenomena that are going on that we don't quite understand. And they do seem to be, in some cases, in the past couple of decades, been a little bit more extreme. And that's why we're in the drought. So the bottom line is we have large deficits, and just getting it all in one big storm or all in one month is just not possible to manage, or even for the soil and the regular ecosystem to absorb all that to get back to anything that we so-called normal. So La Nina, yes, it's a contributing factor, but there's other things that we don't quite understand with our weather pattern that's been ongoing.
Alan, people, of course, connect all this to, you know, climate change, but climatologically, is this a normal pattern, or are we seeing more situations like this, you know, extreme drought, what Alex just described? You have dry periods, then heavy rains in one month, and then extreme dry period again. Are those things that have happened like that over the course of decades or even centuries since records have been tracked?
You know, we just took a look at kind of the indexing for the precipitation that falls in the in the Sierra Nevada, basically that feeds the Central Valley runoff, which is a lot of the water that's available for California, including Southern California. And if we ranked those, these three-year periods, the driest three-year periods, and the latest, 2020 to 2022, ranks as the driest period on the historical record, which goes back to about 1900 or so. And so, and if you look at the other top ranking ones, 2013 to 2015 was number two, and number three was 2012 to 2014. And of course, the fourth ranking one was the famous drought period in the 70s, so 1975 to 77. So yes, we definitely see a trend where it's not only more variable, but also drier. Oh, the dries are drier. Some of the wets are pretty wet, but the dry periods are dry, and they're lasting multiple years, which is problematic when you have too many dry years in a row.
I know you both don't have crystal balls, but you do have forecast modeling for the coming couple of weeks. Is there a change in this extreme dry, high pressure ridge blocking weather that's kept storms away and the jet stream up? I mean, could there be a pattern change coming in the next few weeks? Alex, what do you see?
No, we don't have crystal balls, but we do in our office have an eight ball. But in all seriousness, you know,
have you shaken it? What does it
it's
say?
It's been sitting
Alex?
In our operations for a long time, and it, you know how they evaporate and they don't work as good. So yeah, we got to resort to the, you know, the computer models. And one of our most challenging forecasts, it's almost easy for me to tell you it's going to rain in 3 days, like the broadcast before. But to tell you if it's going to rain in a month or how much, sometimes it's easier just to tell you a year from now, you know, oh, you're going to have a couple storms in December and you're going to get like 2 inches. The predictability and the error in a 1 month forecast is tremendous. But to answer your question, there's not much indication of a pattern change. You know, there's a big block, there's a big pothole in the Pacific right now, and storms are going up and around them. If you get a little shift, you can be really wet, cold, and stormy like December. But most of the time, you're on the dry side when the whole Pacific is blocked. Now, will we get some rain? Yes. I would be shocked if we don't get some rain in February and into March. But the real question, I think, is there any chance of a miracle, you know, like having a December in March so we can make up for everything we're losing? We're now going to be starting to lose some snowpack as the sun angle gets higher. And the fire weather conditions are already very dry again. And we're going to have a very short green up, unfortunately, and not a lot of flowers.
Alan, you have anything to add to that?
Well, just that our water supply forecast, we did an update in the middle of January and then one at the end of January. And then in that 2 weeks, the water supply forecast dropped basically 10%. and so I think the problem is we have a near normal snowpack, as you said, about close to 90%. But every day that the sun angle gets higher and it's shining on it, you'll lose some of that snowpack just to evaporation, and it won't be available for runoff. And so the water supply forecast is likely to drop even further in the next couple of weeks, which look pretty dry. And as Alex said, you know, beyond 2 weeks, we don't really have a lot of skill. And so that maybe gives us some hope. But the outlook isn't good right now.
Yeah, looking at the models and the extended forecast for the next 14 days, it's goose eggs as far as precipitation chances, at least in Southern California. I want to thank you both. Alan Haynes, hydrologist in charge at the National Weather Service's California-Nevada River Forecast Center. Alex Tardy, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in San Diego. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Jane and Fiona are Taiwanese-American women who both grew up in Los Angeles. The friends first met in the eighth grade, and their friendship spans 30 years. They've gone from adolescence to personhood, sometimes together, but sometimes apart, too. And the reason I know so much about them is because they're the main characters in Jean Chen Ho's debut novel called Fiona and Jane. It's a collection of short stories that Jean, a native Angeleno, just recently published. And Jean is here to talk about it right now. Welcome to you, Jean.
Hi, I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Congratulations, by the way, on all the success of the book. Tell us a bit about Jane and Fiona.
Oh, thanks. Well, like you said, it's my first book, so this is all very new and exciting to me. But it is a book about friendship, and in particular, the titular characters, Fiona and Jane, are two Taiwanese-American girls who grew up together. And the book spans about, you know, over 20 years of their friendship. So, you know, they drift apart and then they come back together again, and they have to figure out how to be friends again as adults. And, you know, through their friendship and other relationships in the book, they explore sexuality, identity, heartbreak, all kinds of fun stuff like that.
These stories, Jean, these vignettes, essays, they read like, you know, that they actually happened. I mean, is any of this based on things that have happened in your life?
You know, that's a very common question that I've been getting. And I have to say, unfortunately, these characters get to have so much more fun than I have had in my life. And they also get into a lot more trouble. That was part of the fun, in a sadistic way, I might say, of writing this book, is that, you know, I put them in really awful, heartbreaking situations sometimes. So I would say about 90 to 95% of the circumstances in the book are totally made up. But, you know, the feelings that they go through and the growth are certainly things that I have experienced. So I think it would be fair to say that I share emotional DNA with these characters.
Well, who closely resembles you, though? Which one of these girls turned women closely resembles you?
I think there's a little bit of me in both of them. I mean, I am an only child like Jane. I, like Fiona, went to UC Berkeley and then moved to New York City in my 20s, though she's more tough than me. She, in the book, stays in New York for about a decade. I only stayed there for about 3 years before I came back to LA with my tail between my legs because I could not survive the harsh winters of New York City. But, you know, they go through a lot of romantic ups and downs, and I have certainly gone through a lot of those as well. So I can't say that I'm more like one or the other. I really, you know, got to live two really full, exciting lives by writing these women.
Jane and Fiona, or Ona as she was born, are in Taiwan for a large portion of the first two essays in the book. And I feel like location plays a big role in this book. How do you see the relationships, their relationships to Taipei, respectively?
Well, Fiona was born in Taipei, and she immigrated to Southern California with her mother as a young girl. So she has actually a much closer relationship to Taipei, having grown up there. Whereas Jane was born in the U.S. and her parents are immigrants, so she doesn't have really that lived experience. But as you mentioned in the first story, she goes to Taiwan to visit her father when she's a senior in high school, and she discovers a really big secret that really carries throughout the rest of this book about her dad.
Yeah, we don't want to give away any spoilers, so you'll have to read to know what that secret is. But there is, I mean, it's there are so many levels to this book, and that's what makes it so interesting too. Do Fiona and Jane, do they see LA as their eventual home? I mean, they obviously do a lot in LA.
Yeah. I mean, so Fiona goes to New York. She really wants to get away from LA. You know those kinds of people who don't have a real appreciation for our beloved city here. And so she really wants to get away and, you know, explore and like stretch her wings, right? But eventually she makes her way back to LA in her 30s, and Jane has been living in LA this whole time. So the latter part of the book is really about Fiona finding her footing in LA again as an adult.
Fiona moves to the States when she's six, as you mentioned, and for the most part, Jane and Fiona spend their formative years in Los Angeles. On page 54 in the story Inheritance, you write about how much Fiona relied on Jane while growing up here in LA. Would you mind reading a little bit from that part?
Yeah, I'd love to. If not for Jane, she thought, her loneliness might have been unbearable. Her parents were from Taiwan, too, but Jane was born here in California. She spoke crooked Mandarin, a bad student at weekend Chinese school. Jane's tonal accents were often mixed up and off-key, a funny song that made Fiona giggle, though she found comfort in the fact that they both had to grope for words. Jane was a wonder, Fiona's first friend in this foreign place, an American Taiwanese girl.
How do you see their experiences, Jane? You know, Fiona, who migrated, Jane, who's first generation. Their experience is being shaped by growing up in LA, if at all.
I think that, you know, if you read the book, there's another really good friend of theirs named Won Kim, who is Korean-American, and he grew up with them. And there's a story that follows the inheritance where the three of them are teenagers, and I have them go get fake IDs at the Norwalk swap meet. And then they learn how to drink soju and beer at a Korean drinking place. So I think one of the things that's really special about growing up in Southern California, like I did, is that there's a particularly Asian American experience where, you know, I'm Taiwanese American, and I'm very proud of that fact. I have lots of Taiwanese American friends, but I also grew up here in SoCal where I got to have lots of different kinds of Asian American friends, whether Indian American, Pakistani American, Korean American, lots of people with different migration histories, whether it was generations ago or it was just their parents a few years ago. So I think that that is a very particularly Southern California experience that I try to put in the book.
You started writing this book 5 years ago. How did it come to be? What made you think about writing this? And did you think at first maybe I'll write something about my own life or, you know, my migration from New York to LA or whatever it may be, being born in Taiwan?
Well, yeah, it took me 5 years to write this book. I'm a grad student at USC, so I am finishing up my PhD in creative writing and literature. And one of my fabulous writer professor mentors, Dana Johnson, helped me to really begin looking at some of the stories that I had been working on 5 years ago. And she encouraged me to continue exploring these two characters and their friendship over time. And under her encouragement, I really just allowed these stories to breathe. And it was sort of like from one story to the next, I would find a seed that I wanted to know a little bit more about. So it was a very organic experience. I almost didn't quite realize that I was writing a book. I was just trying to get to know these characters.
Jean Chen Ho, author of the book Fiona and Jane. It's out now at your local bookstore like Skylight and Vroman's, Diesel, SO1. Jean, thanks for the time. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Southern California is known worldwide as a mecca for surfing. And Dana Point in Orange County is one of the reasons why. At Waterman's Plaza there, a bunch of statues of great surfers speak to the city's rich history and connection to the sport. But until recently, the statues were all of, you guessed it, men. Well, that changed last week when a life-sized bronze statue of local surfer Joyce Hoffman was unveiled. It may be the only life-size statue of a woman surfer in America. And Joyce Hoffman joins me right now. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
How's it feel to see this statue of yourself over at Waterman's Plaza? I mean, there were hundreds of people at the ceremony.
Oh, my gosh. It was very overwhelming. It's an incredible honor to myself and to women surfing. And I'm still sort of on cloud nine about it. I have to pinch myself just to remind myself that it's true.
What does it say to you that all those statues are of men?
Well, surfing was a man's sport to begin with, and that's okay. But now the women have come to the forefront too, and we're equal with them and holding our own. And so it just shows that we've made tremendous progress.
You were born in Dana Point. When did you start surfing? Did you just have a love of it from the beginning?
No, I did lots of other activities, lots of other sports, and it wasn't until I was about 12 that I thought, you know, this surfing's pretty fun. Maybe I should really sort of dedicate myself to that and see how far we can go with it. And so that was sort of the start of my lifelong passion for surfing.
Is that when you just like walked into the Hobie shop? Down there, we're like, hey, what's this all about?
Well, no, my dad was a longtime surfer. He actually helped Hobie learn how to shape boards. My dad taught him how to shape surfboards out of foam blanks.
No kidding.
Yeah, so we have, my family has quite a history in surfing. So I had been around surfing and exposed to it. And then about 12 years old, I really got enamored with surfing and told my dad I really wanted to kind of pursue that. And he was, all right, if that's what you want to do, then let's get going here.
So you became the first known woman to surf in 1968, to surf the Banzai Pipeline in Hawaii.
Correct.
What was that like?
It was rather awe-inspiring and intimidating. I was on the beach with my father and my mom, and we were watching the surf, and Bud Brown, who was a videographer of surfing in the early days, was there with his camera, and he said, you know, I've got my camera. If you go out, I think you'll be the first woman to ever surf the pipeline. And I thought, well, what the heck? Let's give it a shot. So I went out, and the rest is history.
You have won all kinds of surfing competitions and accolades all over the world. Were you able to support yourself as a pro surfer? I mean, or did you always need like a side job to keep you financially afloat?
Yeah, in the 60s, you weren't supporting yourself by surfing. I got, you know, made some money and got endorsements and whatnot. But I was the first surfer, male or female, to take it to the next level of really a sport. I was very dedicated to training. I was very focused on competition. So I was the first one to cross train. I paddled and I ran and I lifted weights and I wanted to compete. And so when I decided surfing was going to be my venue, then my focus was on competition. Nowadays, you know, everybody cross trains and everybody runs and does weights and has trainers and whatnot. But I really was the first one to bring that to surfing. So today it's a much more sophisticated sport than it was when I was involved.
Your statue, by the way, joins those of Hobie Alter and Bruce Brown and John Severson and Phil Edwards.
Yep.
Why do you think Dana Point has produced so many surf icons?
I'm not really sure. It is kind of amazing how many of them, you know, and Gordon Clark, who is the biggest foam manufacturer in the world, lived right down the street from us when I was growing up. It really was a hotbed of the surfing culture. And, you know, it's a beautiful area, beautiful Southern California beaches there. Before the harbor, Doheny and Killer Dana were well-known surf breaks. And then just down the few miles down the road, you've got the Trestle. And churches, which are famous breaks. So I think we were all directed here and came here because of the surf that was available and the lifestyle that was here in the early 60s.
You're 75 years old now. Are you out of the water, or are you still going to?
No,
to...
I surfed yesterday.
You're still riding the waves.
I am, as long as I can.
What kind of board do you use now? You said your father was the one who helped Hobie shape those boards, right?
Yes, yes. My brother-in-law, Herbie Fletcher, is a very renowned surfer. And so he made me the last board. I have a 9-foot long board that I surf regularly. And then I have an 8-10 stand-up surfboard that I also surf.
Are there any secret breaks that you don't tell people about?
Oh, goodness. If I had one, I wouldn't tell you.
You wouldn't tell me. Of course not. But do you have one?
Yes, there is a secret. It's not that it's that good, but yes, there is a secret break that I go to regularly.
And maybe it's not as crowded. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. I go there because I'm usually the only one in the water.
Well, I want to congratulate you. You certainly have ripped through a lot of barriers over the years. Joyce Hoffman, who now is bronzed. She has a life-size statue over at Dana Point's Waterman's Plaza. Joyce, congratulations, and thanks for coming on the show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, the Super Bowl is coming to L.A. in a week and a half. Can you believe it? Specifically, it's coming to Inglewood. And the local community is keeping score. Who's winning from all the hoopla and attention? And who's throwing a flag? That's tomorrow on GLA. Always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Access any episode at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Or, of course, you can get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and attention tonight. Have a great night.